Welcome back. You're listening to Policy and Pino, an ongoing discussion series on Rhode Island Public Radio in concert with the elegant and beautiful Providence Athenaeum. The only thing better looking than the books here is the people. Joining me is Scott McKay, Maureen Moakley, and Pablo Rodriguez, and we're talking about Rhode Island's 2014 election season. The Rhode Island Republican Party doesn't have much of a farm system when it comes to politics, but one of the party's best candidates is State Senator Dawson Hodgson, who is challenging Democratic Attorney General Peter Kilmartin for the Attorney General's office. Maureen, how do you see the main differences between Hodgson and Kilmartin and the outlook for the race?
Well, I really do think that Hodgson is a very talented individual. He's made his mark in the Senate. He is a reform candidate. He's very progressive. He's very articulate. Unfortunately, he doesn't have any money, and he's not part of the establishment. And so right now, it looks like Peter Kilmartin has the edge. But it's interesting, as this 38 Studios unfolds, and to the extent that the Attorney General gets involved in it, and also investigations about lobbyists and so forth, it is conceivable that if things came down the wrong way, Dawson Hodgson could be a credible candidate. The problem is, as I say, he doesn't have any money, and it's very hard to get beyond that. But he will be in the general election, and we'll have to wait and see.
Pablo Rodriguez, who knows where it will go from here, but as of the last most recent campaign finance reports, Kilmartin had about five times as much money. Hodgson has been very outspoken in calling for an independent probe on 38 Studios. He's had some other issues that might resonate with voters. How do you break down that matchup between message and money between Hodgson and Kilmartin?
Well, I think the main problem is that this is an attorney general's race. And, you know, it's not a race that attracts a lot of attention when you have all the oxygen being pulled out by the gubernatorial. So I think that I interviewed him last Saturday on my radio show, and I couldn't tell if he was a Democrat or a Republican by the way he answered. I prepared for the show by going to his website, and nowhere in his website does he say that he's a Republican. The website is green. So that's the only way I knew that he was a Republican. But the word Republican doesn't appear in his campaign website. So that tells you something.
Scott McKay, you probably remember the time once we had Dawson Hodgson in our studio at Rhode Island Public Radio. He said the main difference between at the General Assembly isn't really Democrats and Republicans, but adults and children. Does his messaging and his profile as a more socially moderate, economically conservative guy, does that present a compelling challenge for Kilmartin?
Well, I think what he's going to need, and this happens at the Attorney General's office, things can blow up on you there. In Rhode Island, the Attorney General is the DA and the AG, and I think he needs Kilmartin to fumble the ball on something, frankly, to give him an opening. I mean, the fact is, Hodgson, he's qualified. He used to be a state prosecutor. He's a well-educated guy. He's a smart fellow. But again, given the dynamics of this year when all the oxygen is going to be sucked out of the tent, I mean, the Providence Journal can only cover 2.5 races at once. The TV, the amount of money that's going to be spent on the television is going to be monumental, particularly in the governor's race. There's a U.S. Senate race where Jack Reed's sitting on $3 million, even though he's not going to have a real election, probably. But he's going to spend that money because he wants to make sure nobody 6 years down the road has the idea of running against him. So it's going to be an uphill battle, I think, for Mr. Hodgson.
In the other state general offices, the lieutenant governor's office will be open because Elizabeth Roberts has served two terms and can't seek re-election. Vying to succeed her are Secretary of State Ralph Mollis and Cumberland Mayor Daniel McKee, both Democrats. And a liberal state representative from Warwick, Frank Ferry, is taking a look at running for the race. Scott, how do you, what do you say about this matchup?
Well, first of all, if there were no lieutenant governor, how could you tell? I mean, I think this is basically not much of an election. What really surprises me, given that the seat is open, I'm surprised Clay Pell didn't walk in here with $400,000 and run for lieutenant governor. I think you could have walked in. But he decided not to do that. So what you have now is pretty much there'll be an insider-outsider thing. McKee is already going after Mollis, saying that Mollis is the good old boy network and these kinds of things. Mollis, as you recall, almost lost his primary last time. So it's not general, excuse me, last time. So it's not going to be a walk-in, I don't think, for him. But certainly, Rhode Islanders love elections, and we'll vote in this one. But it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the future of our little state.
Maureen Moakley, we see how Ralph Moss has the support of party insiders, and Dan McKee has the edge in fundraising, and Frank Ferry might have a more liberal base. How do you see the three of those potentially matching up?
Well, first of all, I think we need a lieutenant governor, but I think we need it paired with the governor. And I think if they put that on the ballot, it would give the governor's office a little more heft. And we can't go into it, but there are states that are wanting because they don't have a lieutenant governor. But as far as this race is concerned, Ralph Mollis has been successful because he has pursued the urban strategy that I talked about. He carries Providence, he carries East Providence, North Providence, Johnson, and Pawtucket. And that's a fairly firm grouping, sort of a machine, if you will. The only interesting thing is McKee has cut into that now because he's pulled away the Johnson group. So he's got, so that coalition is unraveling, A. B, McKee is progressive in the sense that he's a supporter of charter schools. So there's a progressive element up there that is likely to support him.
But unions don't like him because of that.
Obviously. And so there's the tension there. And the third thing is he would traditionally be, because of that, a suburban vote. But we don't know if Frank Ferry gets in, how Ferry is going to affect that. He's from Cranston. So that would be
Warwick.
A constituency.
From Warwick.
Warwick, excuse me. That would be a constituency that might make a difference.
Pablo Rodriguez, Warwick is the Rodon's second largest community. A lot of votes there. Do you think there's an opening here for Frank Ferry?
Absolutely. Frank Ferry has been a leader in the marriage equality movement here in Rhode Island, and that gives him a built-in grassroots campaign of people that will go to bat for him and get the vote out and get people out. So he has a very good chance of doing this. I disagree with Scott in terms of the lieutenant governor. If we didn't have Elizabeth Roberts for the last 8 years, we wouldn't have healthcare reform in the state today. And we have to be very grateful for the work that she did as lieutenant governor. So the lieutenant governor can be a powerful figure if they choose to be one.
Now, the treasurer's office will be open because, in case you haven't heard, Gina Raimondo is running for governor. There are no Republican candidates in sight at this point, and three Democrats are fighting against each other. Former treasurer Frank Caprio, young up-and-comer Seth Magaziner, and former state auditor general Ernest Almonte. Pablo, what do you see among these three Democrats who hope to be treasurer?
Well, you know, Seth is a young man with very little experience, so it's going to be very difficult for him to make a case that that he can take on this very challenging job of treasurer. But he's working very hard. He has a lot of support outside of Rhode Island, obviously, with his father and his connections to the Clintons.
He's also worked at an investment firm in Boston.
Of course, so he's going to be able to raise and to put in enough money. Ernie Almonte is a real, you know, the most knowledgeable, you could say, of the whole race. I mean, he has been working in state government for all these years as an auditor general, and he really has the knowledge to be the treasurer. But he doesn't have the fire that other candidates have, you know, and makes it difficult for people to just jump. Frank Caprio is a new man. I interviewed him last Saturday in my show. He is repentant. He sounds relaxed. And he is going to be a formidable candidate.
Maureen, how do you describe the differences and similarities between these three Democratic candidates for treasurer?
I tend to agree with Pablo. I mean, I think Frank Caprio has, first of all, he did a relatively good job as treasurer. And so he's got that under his belt. He's got a lot of money. He is a new man, so to speak. And so I think he's a formidable candidate. And the other thing is, in a three-way race, I think that advantages him. So, I mean, Ernie Almonte is knowledgeable. He's personable. But I'm not so sure he has a strong network, a base of support that can carry them through. Certainly the Caprios can put that together. So I would want to say that, and although Seth Magaziner is very, accomplished and an up-and-coming a public servant, I really think that I think Frank Caprio is likely to win this race.
What do you say about the race for treasurer, Scott?
I think Seth Magaziner is going to surprise some people because I think El Monte and Caprio are going after the same pool of voters, essentially, the old-time Democrats. And I think that Magaziner, with his money and his smarts, he has a very good tale to tell. And I think he'll do pretty well. Is Caprio the new Caprio, or is this a version of the new Nixon? I mean, it's interesting. I wonder, in a way, why this guy wants the same job back that he had, 4 years ago. To me, it's like you get a divorce and you want to go back with the same woman.
Well, there are also some races for federal offices this year. They're kind of similar in that some entrenched incumbents don't have experienced opponents. Senator Jack Reed is up for election, as well as Rodin's two congressmen, Jim Langevin and David Cicilline. There's kind of a cast of first-time candidates running against Cicilline, Republican Rue Reese against Langevin, and possibly Warwick City employee Ray McKay against Reed if he can get a clearance. He's not going to lose his job. How do you see the outlook on those races, Scott?
Well, you'd have to give the incumbents a nod right now. The strange thing about Congress is everybody can't stand Congress. Their approval ratings are like 12-13%, and yet their own Congress people keep getting reelected. Incumbents get reelected with more than 90%. It's this conundrum of American politics, and it happens somewhat at the State House. It's not my gal or my guy's fault. It's all the rest of those terrible people down there. Jack Reed basically has the safest Democratic Senate seat in the country, I would argue. And the thing he's got now is, if he wins, he's a lock to become the head of the Armed Services Committee. We've already seen all the submarine building jobs he's been able to steer down to Electric Boat. So I think Reed's in a very, very good position for reelection. He's got $3 million in the bank, and he'll have a unified party. And everybody else, I don't see a Republican yet who's put together the money and the message that you need to knock off one of these Democrats.
Maureen, why doesn't the Republican Party have a better bench and farm system to develop candidates who might run initially for the General Assembly before seeking Congress here?
Well, because we don't have that many Republicans in this state. This is one of the most solidly Democratic states in the country, and there's not a lot of Republicans there. And also, when you talk about the candidates that are up, they want to win. The Democrats want to win as much as they can. Reed wants to put his numbers up. And so in that sense, I think it's a very, very hard thing to do. I do think that David Cicilline will be one who will continually have to face primary challenges. I think he's in a little bit of a delicate position, and I think you may see some primary challenges. And my latest explanation of what's going to happen to Clay Pell is that he will lose gracefully, he will take his $1 million left, put it in a federal fund, and begin to run against David Cicilline.
Pablo, what are you looking for in these congressional races?
Well, what happens with the Republicans here in New England, not just in Rhode Island, is that the type of Republicans that would win in this area are no longer welcome in Washington. That branch of the Republican Party really has disappeared. And therefore, for a Republican to mount a credible campaign for Congress, they need to have the Tea Party. They need to have all these kinds of Republicans that are really not the type of Republican that we see in this area of the country. So it's very hard for me to see anyone rising to the challenge of incumbents with a lot of money, a lot of recognition, and frankly have done a good job.
Scott McKay recently spoke with former U.S. Attorney Robert Clark Carrante. He said he thought something that could help to reduce the threat of corruption in Rhode Island is a more robust two-party system. We see how the Republicans, even just in the Rhode Island House of Representatives, have seen their ranks shrink from about 15 to 6 representatives over the last 10 years. Why is it so tough for Republicans here to become a more effective political body?
There's a couple of reasons. I think one of them Pablo touched on. I think it's very hard to recruit young people in New England, particularly in southern New England, anywhere outside New Hampshire, actually, into the National Republican Party, particularly women. I mean, there was a time in Rhode Island when you had Susan Farmer, Claudine Schneider, when women were the fulcrum, again, of some of the candidates who would win statewide and legislative seats. And nationally now, it's very hard with the anti-gay marriage, with a party that really, to a large degree, has been captured by its conservative wing, by the states of the old Confederacy, particularly on social issues. And it's sad because if this state needs one thing badly, it's good two-party competition and real choices in elections. We don't have enough of that. We need more of that. That and an aroused citizenry is really, I think, would help the state a lot.
Maureen, did you have a word there?
Yeah, I just like to put in a word. Scott and I disagree about this, but one thing that will help the situation along, in my opinion, is the master lever. That is that it will increase competition at the local level. In New Hampshire, it was solidly Republican. They eliminated the master lever, and the state became more democratic. It became more competitive. So he and I disagree, but I do think that'll help.
Texas has a master lever. They're the most Republican state in the country.
And we still have not lost the master lever.
Pablo, as you say, we still do have the master lever. The House has voted to do away with it, but the issue is still hanging in the Senate. What do you expect to happen there?
I was just so disappointed by the Judicial Committee's decision to study the issue that we have studied for the last 40 years, whether we should eliminate the master lever. Just say we don't want to vote, period, instead of just coming with this stupid excuse that they want to study the issue. What's there to study? There's nothing to study. They don't want it because they see it as a way of perpetuating the power of one party.
Or don't forget, it's the last minutes of the legislature. They may be holding it to trade for something else. And these last-minute horse trades that always go on between the House and the Senate.
But it'll be interesting to see whether they can hold off.
One other issue that we'll see more of after the primary season is the pension debate, the court battle over this. What are you watching for on that, Scott?
Well, I just think that this is going to be a gravy train for lawyers. It's going to be litigated all the way to the state Supreme Court. We both know that. And I think in the end, the state Supreme Court, although I'm not a lawyer, I'm no expert, I just think they'll probably cut the baby in half. They'll say your pension is your pension. That is a property right or a contract right, whatever. But the COLAs are the province of the General Assembly, and I think they won't want to bankrupt the state, but I don't think they want to hurt or take away anyone's vested pension.
How about you, Maureen?
Well, I'm inclined to think that the courts will find at the Superior Court level, I think they'll find for the unions. I do think when it gets up to the Supreme Court level, I think given if what's in the Constitution, I think they will find for the reforms. That is, they cannot undo what they started doing from 2009 till now. And there's is it a contract? And there's nothing in our Constitution that says that. And secondly, is there a compelling state interest to do this? To start unpacking this now would be, I think, a financial and political disaster.
Last word here to Pablo Rodriguez.
Revenue is down. Medicaid is up. We're getting casinos in Massachusetts. There's not going to be any money left by the time we decide in the courts. And whatever they decide, there's going to be another pension reform bill to be able to pay for whatever it is that they decide.
All right. You've been a great audience. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to Rhode Island Public Radio News Director Catherine Welch, General Manager Joe O'Connor, Christina Bevilacqua, and Allison from the Providence Athenaeum, and all of you who've joined us, please give yourselves a hand. And I'd also like to thank our all-star panel of Maureen Moakley, Pablo Rodriguez, and Scott McKay. How about a hand for them? Thank you. I'm Rhode Island Public Radio political reporter Ian Donis. Thanks again for joining us.